The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 59. Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show. All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone to the Rebel Capitalist Show that I have a tremendous amount of respect for. A good buddy of mine on Twitter. He does an awesome job breaking down the macro environment. His name is Jason Burek. Jason, welcome to the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Oh, thank you, George. I love your show. I watch it. I watch as many as I can. I mean, I'm so busy making my own content, but I do. I finished your Cashless Society video late last night.
Yeah, that was a good one. You know, people accuse me of having clickbait titles. And I said, look at that one. If you're not terrified after that video, then I don't think you know the history of central banks or of governments, that's for sure. But so for my viewers who don't know your backstory, Jason, it's fascinating, and you're a real pro. You've been at this a long time, although you're a pretty young guy. Can you fill us in there?
Yeah, I sound like I'm 25 still, but I'm actually closer to 40 now. So I guess this is kind of a blessing. But my journey really started in 2007. I started reading some basic Warren Buffett value investing investors books. I dropped out of law school. I got a job as a stockbroker. And unfortunately, through no fault of my own, just bad luck, bad timing, I was a stockbroker at a firm during the 2008 financial crisis while everything was crashing.
Oh, wow.
And my dad had regular money at another major stockbroker, regular stockbroker, and his broker wouldn't call him back on the phone, wouldn't answer. For months, he wouldn't get an answer about what to do, and he lost a lot of money. My grandma, before she passed, she had inherited a substantial amount of money inheritance from my grandfather, who had passed a couple years before. And unfortunately, after my grandmother passed, my dad and my mom got their share of the inheritance, and we're going through it. And unfortunately, my grandmother had been fleeced for hundreds of thousands of dollars in mortgage-backed securities and real estate investment trusts and other toxic garbage, bad bank stocks, preferred shares in bank stocks. And a lot of these things went down 90% or more in value. Some of them collapsed.
Wow.
So I wanted answers. I wanted answers. I didn't like my job in the regular financial industry because it was just a sales job. So I wanted to learn, and then I started on my own path. There was a lot of painful growing pains. I interviewed over 500 different experts, people like you with different backgrounds in the oil market. I worked different jobs in the financial industry. I was an oil analyst for my day job, also covering dividend stocks and some other small cap stocks for a day job in the past. And then I've been hired to write research reports in the past for high net worth clients worth 7 or 8 figures.
Okay, great. So that brings us up to speed here. One thing that I'm personally curious about, Jason, is I know you really lean toward the Austrian school, and you've got a libertarian slant to you. How did that come about? Was that as of 2008, or were you leaning that direction before? What was the catalyst?
Well, I always liked capitalism, and I always dreamed of owning my own business. But after 2008, I saw all the rules changes and all the crazy things that the federal government and the central bank and the banks were doing and getting away with and the bailouts. And I just said, this is morally wrong. None of this is fair. The people on Main Street were hurting. I was a regular person on Main Street. I was working in the financial industry as a, you know, lowly investment advisor representative or stockbroker. And I was just a salesperson, and they weren't telling us. So we didn't know, and I wanted answers. So I found Peter Schiff's work. That was the first person that woke me up. He red-pilled me, if you want to use that phrase.
Yeah.
And from there, I started reading like Economics in One Lesson, Mises Institute. And then I started interviewing people, other experts, and asking them a lot of hard questions. So questions, mostly just questions. And I take a lot of time to write questions. I have like a legal pad, and I spend at least 20 or 30 minutes writing out questions. So I try to do this very, very thoroughly when I do interviews, and I've done over 500. And it was just mostly questions that I myself wanted answered. And then I'd listen to the interviews later. And this was in addition to, besides interviewing a bunch of people, also reading over 500 books about business, investing, entrepreneurship, and doing the interviews. And that's why I think over 10 years now, I've improved so much.
Yeah, well, you definitely have an incredible grasp of macro, that is for sure. I think you have a much more detailed
grasp of it than I do. I kind of understand how things work and put the pieces of the puzzle together, but you really understand it from a bottoms up and a tops down. So I know before we were recording, you were talking about the global economy and how it was really kind of sick, for lack of a better word, prior to the pandemic that we're dealing with right now. So can you kind of dive into the research and kind of the facts and the data? And I know you've got a couple articles that we're going to review to show my viewers just how broken the economy was prior to this, and therefore maybe why it might not be a V-shaped recovery.
Sure. The U.S. economy had better economic data than pretty much every other single country, especially all the major export giants like Germany and South Korea, by enormous long shot. And there was a lot of problems in China. And when China has a lot of economic problems, emerging markets that export to China, emerging markets that have enormous amounts of exposure to commodities, so base metal, energy, those emerging markets, the companies in those emerging markets don't just get sick, they get deathly sick.
Right.
So the last 12 to 18 months, the export data from South Korea, which 50% of their GDP is exports. I was doing interviews with my friend Adam Tamerkin, who looks at these leading economic indicators out of South Korea. And we were discussing this on my YouTube channel for interviews over the last, a couple interviews over the last 18 to 24 months. And we were going through this data and it was just getting worse. So South Korea was in a recession well over 12 months ago. Germany was in a recession all of 2019. And the economic data, long before China got the global pandemic, the economic data in China was really, really bad. Now, I have contacts, as you know, inside mainland China. I have a really good friend that was trapped inside Wuhan for over 50 days, quarantine and lockdown. So I was getting a lot of detailed reports early to mid-January about what was going on. But I also have other contacts that were sending me some photos and analysis, including how like factories in Fujian. And in Fujian, there's a lot of shoe factories like Nike and Reebok and Adidas, how some of those factories were literally alternating months on and off. So there was a lot of red flags with the Chinese economy for over 12 months. I would say the Chinese economy was deteriorating, was contracting violently, way, way more than the official Chinese economic data. And then China also had the African swine flu prior to the global pandemic. And the African swine flu was devastating the pork population in China. Some estimates I've seen, there's 70% or more of their pork population. And so there was really, really bad stagflation in the Chinese economy on rent prices and also food prices. So the Chinese economy was in serious, serious problems. You also had almost a year ago, it was 11 months ago, you had Baoshang Bank. And that was the Chinese version, in my opinion, of the repo madness that we had here in September. So Baoshang Bank was really the big, big warning sign, because within 2 or 3 months, you had at least 6 banks officially that China acknowledged that had to be bailed out or merged. And the bailouts that were going on, I did a video on this on my YouTube channel, George, not sure if you saw it last year. It was called China's Very Dangerous Fiat Currency and Credit Situation. And the types of bailouts that the Chinese economy was doing for over 12 months, really, before the global pandemic was absolutely enormous. Their repo spikes inside China started in January 2019. And by the summer of 2019, you had just an insane amounts of different types of bailouts inside the Chinese economy. The craziest bailout that I saw was China Construction Bank, which is one of the two largest state-owned enterprise banks in China. And the Chinese government and the People's Bank of China, their central bank, ordered this enormous bank to bail out Hunan province at the tune of $300 billion over, I think, a 5-year span. And that would be the equivalent if here in the United States, if the federal government or the Federal Reserve asked JP Morgan to bail out the state of Illinois.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds like they're bailing out an entire state.
Yeah, wow. It's a province. It's a very large province. So it was absolutely enormous. There were reports from Michael Pettis and Leland Miller of China Beige Book that a lot of, and the New York Times ran a story on this, I think in August 2019. It was extremely detailed about many provincial and local government employees in China that were not being paid on time for months. Even state-owned enterprises were not paying their bills on time. So the Chinese economy, really the global pandemic was the last thing that the Chinese economy needed, because the Chinese economy was already in peril for, I would say, 12 months at least. But China's problems started before that. They started really in 2015 and 16. Kyle Bass has talked about this a lot with how their official reserves dropped $1 trillion in only 12 months.
You're talking about their dollar reserves.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, Jason, before you go into this, just for the viewers, can you explain why the Chinese dollar reserves are so important to China? Because if I'm just an average Joe, I'm like, okay, well, so what? I'm China. I don't really deal in dollars. What's the difference between having $4 trillion U.S. dollars and $2 trillion? I mean, it's nice to have the extra money, but am I really screwed if it goes down by $2
trillion? Okay, so most foreign exchange reserves or sovereign wealth funds are used for investments normally, but foreign exchange reserves are normally used to protect the exchange rate of the currency, to protect the currency. Like what happened in the Asian Tiger crisis. So the Asian Tiger crisis, you had, I'll just give a very quick summary.
You
had all these Asian countries that had dollar pegs. And so they had run up too much debt, and the currency traders were temporarily, they had offered higher interest rates for foreign investors, foreign direct investors to come in, but this was hot money that could leave. So the debt problems in these Asian countries started to balloon, and then the hot money, so net capital outflows, started leaving. So then the government finances became in peril, and the currency exchange rate started to really wobble, and the Fed at that point had to step in. That's when the currency swaps, the central bank level currency swaps, started, but they were much, much smaller back then. They started, I think initially, James Turk has talked about this in his latest book with John Rubino, that the original currency swaps were for like $8 billion, $10 billion, from the Asian Tiger crisis in Mexico. So at that point, when foreign banks blew up and the Wall Street banks or hedge funds had leveraged currency trades or foreign government bond trades that went bad, the Fed has always been willing to step in and do these currency swap lines. But the foreign governments got in serious, serious trouble with the dollar pegs because they ran out of foreign exchange reserves to defend the pegs.
Right. Yeah, that's the bottom line, I think, is that if you're XYZ country and you are not on the dollar, but you've got your currency pegged to the dollar, if that goes against you, you need dollars to defend your currency, because you need dollars to go to sell into the market to buy back your currency to keep that peg. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, dollars are also earned through global trade. But what you've seen with a lot of the emerging markets is they've been moving their global trade away from the US and more towards China. And so China normally wants to do a lot of global trading in their own currency. But then you've had a lot of these emerging markets, since the dollar got low, you've been talking about this extensively in your interviews and videos. When that dollar got low, that's when those emerging market countries, they got greedy. They used leverage and other stupidity, and they thought that that trend would continue. So they borrowed in dollars, even though they were trying to do trading outside of the dollar with China.
Right, because they could get dollars at a very low interest rate, a lot lower interest rate than they could borrow in their own currency or XYZ currency.
Yes. Yes, okay, but cool. Then they got hit. They got hit with a bunch of unexpected headwinds. So that the headwinds were the commodities bear market started. And so that means that a lot of these commodity export businesses inside these emerging markets got into trouble. So
because they're getting fewer dollars.
Well, they had dollar denominated debt and the commodity prices were lower. Yes. So ultimately fewer dollars.
Yeah. Because their revenue is for these commodities that are denominated in dollars. Therefore, if the commodity price goes down, that means their dollar revenue goes down, but yet their dollar debt stays the exact same. Okay, so I'm totally clear on this. I think the viewer is now as well. So going back to China, and you said last year, or was it the year prior, where Bass was saying that they had a big problem because their dollar reserves went down by like $1 trillion in just a matter of months.
Sure. This article, which is from Reuters from August 22nd, 2019, is this one is more up to date about what Chinese banks were doing. This is the more recent intervention with the Chinese state-owned banks that were ordered by the Chinese government and the People's Bank of China to start selling, to start doing more forward dollar swaps to help with their foreign exchange reserves and defend their currency exchange rate. This is when the Chinese yuan to the dollar exchange rate went above 7. So they got control of the exchange rate. But I think it's important for your listeners to understand how the Chinese economy has changed a lot in the last 10 years in terms of fundamentals.
Okay.
So about 10 years ago or 12 years ago, I would have agreed with everything Peter Schiff and Jim Rogers said about the Chinese economy, because the debt levels in the Chinese economy, the credit levels were very, very small. I believe it was only about $5 trillion in total credit, and they had $4 trillion in reserves. So this was a much smaller economy, but there was a high savings rate, and it wasn't crazy with the credit bubble. And now you fast forward to what has happened, and the amount of credit inside the Chinese economy, and a lot of it is based on high real estate prices, and high real estate prices as collateral. So you have very similar problems to what happened to the US real estate market, the US real estate bubbles from 2002 to 2007. In fact, a lot of pro-China people and people inside China I've spoken to have told me for the last 2 years that Chinese real estate prices won't fall. So it's the attitude, the perception, the government won't allow it. The Chinese government at the provincial level and at the national level has canceled, I don't know the exact amount, but certain real estate sales that would indicate that prices were falling. And one of China's largest real estate developers, Evergrande Group, had just had an enormously horrible earnings, minus 50% on profits. And the Chinese economy, for the first time that I've ever seen the data, Tavi Costa, the hedge fund manager from Prescott Capital, digged into the Chinese data from the China National Bureau of Statistics, and what it has shown is that this first quarter for 2020, that the amount of real estate investment in China collapsed. So this is the first time on record of any data set since 2001 that real estate investment in China is not positive. It dropped 16%. And the reason why that's important for your listeners is you have a credit bubble in China. You have a banking system that is more than twice as large as the US's banking system. And that banking system, all the collateral, all the assets, is all based on high real estate prices. And there's a great book out by Dinny McMahon. This is a must read for your listeners who want to understand this. It's called China's Great Wall of Debt. He speaks fluent Mandarin. He lived there for 10 years. I've interviewed him on my channel last year in 2019. I don't think he's allowed back in the country because he criticized the country, but the book is phenomenal. And he details how a lot of these Chinese factory owners over the last 5 years, including stories, individual conversations with some of these factory owners, that they didn't know anything about real estate, but they couldn't make any money at any of their manufacturing or factory businesses. And so they pledged their factories as collateral, even though they were still running the factories, and then went into real estate construction and real estate speculation and real estate business. And so a lot of the Chinese economic growth, according to Jim Chanos, about 25%, depending upon how you measure it, of China's GDP is based on speculative real estate construction. And when you add that with the China's export economy now, and how a lot of the higher end consumers in the European Union, in the US, that China normally exports to are not going to be consuming as much, that 65% of the Chinese GDP is in peril.
That makes a lot of sense. So when you say that the Chinese, they're not exporting as much, and that's a huge driver for their economy, just like the, sounds like the real estate is internally, do you see that being a long-term issue or a temporary issue? And the reason I'm saying that is because right now with the, we'll call it the cervasis sickness, you've got a lot of, there's an attitude, there's a narrative out there towards deglobalization. Like, why are we dependent on China for our face masks, as an example? And I'm not saying, obviously there's pros and cons to globalization, but there's a push for that, and you've got all these supply chains that are being disrupted. So do you think that, I guess my first question would be, this is a long-term structural issue, and if so, is that going to really be damaging to the Chinese economy, not just over the next 6 months, but potentially over the next 5-10 years?
Yeah, so it depends, because a lot of Chinese manufacturers were not doing well prior to President Trump putting on the tariffs. So the tariffs that President Trump put on just exacerbated the problems, made things even worse. They turned very marginal Chinese, some Chinese manufacturers, from very marginally profitable into enormous losses. And okay. So that meant that people were looking around for how to make money, which meant that even more people were going to go into that shadow banking system, wealth management products, get shady loans, and get into real estate and construction, yeah, because that was still the best business in China. So you had the credit bubble, you had how much real estate and construction was going on in China, and how much the Chinese economy is dependent upon that. And Kyle Bass has said that there's over $50 trillion in credit now, dollars worth of credit in the Chinese economy. Also, the amount of dollar-denominated debt, too, inside China's economy. So, and China was one of the trading partners that, I think, the largest major trading partner that did not get currency swaps in the press release. But back to your question, I wanted to put those details out there first. So back to your, because how many Chinese manufacturers were hurt by the tariffs? And there's enormous xenophobia in China now, too, especially anti-American. It's changed a lot, the mentality towards trading and trading with foreigners now in China. But now back to your question, it really depends, George, on how many factories leave China in the next 2 to 7 years. And okay, Larry Kudlow has talked about just printing, creating more currency units and paying the bills for all these manufacturers to come back to the U.S. Now, there's a lot of tax and regulatory hurdles with different cities and states that I don't know if that's even possible. I mean, the currency can be printed. I don't know how all the regulatory red tape, how quickly that can be done. But it just depends on how many actual factories leave China in the next 2 to 7 years. But I think it's really clear that relations have changed a lot with the U.S. and China in just the last couple of years, especially once President Trump got elected, because the Chinese were not prepared. I interviewed Tony Nash on my channel. He's a global supply chain expert, and he worked and lived in Asia for 15 years. And he was doing presentations with Chinese government officials after Trump won, but before he put the tariffs on, telling them that Trump's going to put the tariffs on, and they didn't believe him. They said, why would Trump punish us when all these other countries were doing it too? So it really depends on how many factories actually leave China. I think they will, some of them will, in the next 2 to 7 years. It depends. But I think it's really clear that the U.S. and China do not play well together. To use like the old kindergarten analogy, you know, if they can't play nice together, maybe they shouldn't play at all.
Yeah, that makes sense. Just going back one moment so I'm crystal clear. When you say that the manufacturing sector in China was really taking a beating, and it has not just now, but it has over the last few years, why is that? Is that because they overbuilt their manufacturing, or is that because the exports went down because the global demand went down, and therefore maybe it's an indication that the whole that the world economy is sick and not just the Chinese manufacturing sector?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of factors, and you mentioned a few of them. Also, labor costs in China have gone up over 500% in the last 20 years.
Okay.
So China's no longer the lowest cost. So yes, the salaries are cheap compared to what a factory owner here in the U.S. would be paid, but the labor costs are up substantially. So if you want to talk for cheaper manufacturing labor, you're looking at India, Vietnam, Bangladesh, Mexico. You're looking at other countries like that instead now.
Got it. Okay.
So it's all these factors. And then Trump put on the tariffs. And then also with the real estate market, that a lot of these manufacturers were not able to export goods. The demand for some of them had dropped because there was too much misallocation of capital. So people like Peter Schiff, I respect Peter Schiff a lot. I personally think he's just wrong on China. You can, in my opinion, you can misallocate capital with governments to factory owners, because I've heard of many, many stories. Leland Miller of China Beige Book has documented this extensively in his interviews on Real Vision TV and elsewhere, along with other contacts I've spoken to, whether it's Denny McMahon or Tony Nash, in my interview that I did with him in 2019, of Chinese factory owners getting bailed out. So there's no civil unrest. So the Chinese government prints up the capital. That's misallocation of capital there too. And that is somewhat deflationary because you have a lot of factory owners producing goods that the demand is falling and inventory levels are rising, but it's also wasteful. So it's wasteful to build go cities, and it's also wasteful to subsidize. So I criticize all government, George, I try to criticize all governments. Unfortunately, some people criticize me because they call me a China basher. I'm just trying to do balanced analysis that there is problems with the Chinese economy that a lot of people have not spoken about.
Yeah, okay. Makes total sense. So I'm looking at the article that you referenced before. Do you want to move on to a different article? I'm just looking at the one that says major China state-owned banks supporting Yuan.
Okay, that article was from the Chinese banking crisis that was unfolding after Baoshang Bank in May 2019, and then we had Bank of Jinzhou, and then we had Hong Feng Bank, and we had a few other banks of various sizes. But the amount of different bailouts, I did a video on this, a couple of videos on this on my YouTube channel. So this, what China did was they were worried again about their foreign exchange reserves dropping. So they went in and used the derivatives again. And this was involved with the repo. So this was the international, I've said on my YouTube channel many times that there was about four or five major problems in the repo market in September. And this was a major part of the international repo problems, are all these forward dollar swaps that China, Brazil, these other emerging market countries were doing in the dollar funding. They were using dollar funding markets outside the US.
Yeah.
So this was part of the dollar shortage. This was the international part. I mean, you've documented the US repo problems extremely well. So I don't think I need to cover that. You and your guests have done that superbly.
Okay, so outside of the United States, there were huge repo issues, just like we were having them inside the United States in that September 17th date range.
Yes, they were going into dollar funding markets for repo to get dollars to deal with those forward dollar swaps because the positions of those were so large because they did not want to drain all of their foreign exchange reserves too rapidly. But ultimately, that's what's been happening and why you're seeing currency exchange rates for a lot of these different countries, Brazil, Australia, and others. Now, obviously, there's other factors, but the margin call, one of the main reasons for the currency exchange rates is the dollar-denominated debt, but also the forward dollar swaps. So this is something that a lot of financial professionals, I think they only have part of the puzzle here. So pretty much all the ones and I respect all these other people, I just disagree a little bit. So you have the dollar denominated debt, which everyone says is like 12 trillion, 13 trillion. But the other major amount is these forward dollar swaps, which are dollar liabilities. These are derivatives. Derivatives are extremely dangerous, especially if you're a hedge fund using leverage to bet in the derivatives market like in 2008 with mortgage-backed securities and others. But these forward dollar swaps, the size of them, according to this Olga Kotaga article, she put out, she worked her sources. She got amazing information in these articles. These are two articles she put out in 24 hours. So I think these were very, very important. And this was still as the repo crisis was unfolding. You know, things calmed down a little bit in repo. She came out with this article called "In Swaps We Trust: Disappearing Dollars Drive Currency Trading Dependence." And the third paragraph there is swap users had a scare in September when the U.S. Federal Reserve had to pump cash into markets as rates in the $2.2 trillion U.S. repo market spiked and spilled into foreign exchange swap markets, sending the premium to borrow dollars shooting higher.
Yeah, right.
So this becomes a doom vortex loop because they have dollar-denominated debt. They have dollar liabilities in the tens of trillions. In this article here, I think Claudio Borio from the Bank of International Settlements, yeah, he says it later in the article, the paragraph here, borrowing via swaps could amount to $14 trillion or more. Claudio Borio, head of the Bank of International Settlements, Monetary and Economic Department, estimated. So this margin call that we've had in the last 4 or 5 weeks, it's not just on the dollar denominated debt. You have to add in the forward dollar swaps. And then you're looking at, what is it, 12, if you add up 12 trillion and 14 trillion, at least 26 trillion. And they may be underestimating things because the Bank of International Settlements in their December 2019 global macro update that came out, I think, December 8th. So it was before the global pandemic was becoming widespread news and causing all the other destruction in the global economy and the supply chain, there were already problems, as I think I've already documented. So the global pandemic only made things a lot worse, but there were already a lot of problems. And by then, the margin call was $26
trillion. Yeah. Yeah. So do you want to, when you say the margin call, can you unpack that a little for someone who might not understand the kind of finance lingo? And if you're, let's use China as an example, where you've got, let's just call it $10 trillion of debt that you have. Well, let's just use the example of a mortgage. So let's say China has a $10 trillion mortgage that they have to pay, and their payments are, let's just call it the $10 million or $100 million per month. And so they need these dollars to service that debt. And so if China gets a quote-unquote margin call, how does that actually play out? Like what happens there, so we can just put it in like a household term so people totally get it?
Okay, so this would be if you stop making payments on your credit card, the bad things that could happen, or you missed a mortgage payment, or you couldn't pay off like the minimum amount. So this right. would be the version of a margin call. So when the global economy is functioning normally, after the dollar was severed with gold, we basically had a dollar standard. So when global trade was functioning normally, these companies were trading back and forth. American tourists were leaving the United States, and these foreign companies were earning their dollars. But over since the global pandemic started, that has come to a halt. So there's a cash flow problem, an enormous cash flow problem. So you have collateral problem, you have assets turning into liabilities in some cases, and you have a cash flow problem.
Okay. Got it. So the bottom line is although the most people that we see, even kind of some really, really smart people on, let's say, Real Vision, they're talking about the $13 trillion of dollar-denominated debt that corporations and countries have outside the United States. You're saying that, hey, guys, it's even more than that because there are all of these derivatives that are owned outside the United by entities outside the United States that are also denominated in dollars. And if you add everything all together, we're up to 26 or almost $30 trillion that needs to be repaid, or at least needs to be serviced, with very few dollars actually getting outside of the United States.
Bingo. And that's why the Fed put in the global repo. And that's why the dollar index is still at, when we're doing this interview, barely under 99. Because like Brent Johnson says, and I agree with him about this, there's lots of demand for dollars to not default right away. So these foreign companies or foreign governments do not default right away.
Okay, so my next question for you, and you know Brent's work well, Brent is basing his dollar milkshake theory on there being $13 trillion. Of dollar, let's say liabilities outside the U.S. But if you're saying it's $29 trillion, then you've got to be on Brent side's times 100. Like you've got to be the dollar milkshake guy on steroids. But I know you're not. So how do you? What are your cross currents there in your mind that make you say, well, although I totally get Brent's point, and I would take it a step further, I think there's twice as much of the dollar liability out there, I still don't think that would make the dollar, or potentially the dollar still won't go to 110 or 120 or 140 on the DXY. What's the counterbalance to that?
It's actually really simple. And unfortunately, in the world we live in, the rules are constantly changing. The goalposts are being moved. It's like Charlie Brown trying to kick the football and Lucy pulls it all the time. So that's what it is. It's because President Trump, the Trump administration, the U.S. Treasury, and the Federal Reserve will announce on maybe a daily basis new programs for bailouts, new programs to buy assets to try to devalue the dollar, to try to prevent. So I really believe that when the dollar index hit 103, that was full-blown panic move. I honestly think, and Brent Johnson was going to be right, Raoul Powell of Real Vision was going to be right about this, but what happened was, there was enormous intervention. The rules changed, global repo. So these foreign governments did not have to blow through all their reserves, dump their treasuries for dollars, and the global repo market was the Fed's global repo bailout fund was established. So how could the Fed stop this again? The Fed could announce to try to weaken the dollar. And I don't, they're clearly watching the exchange rate for the dollar and the dollar index. So they can't do, in my opinion, I don't think that they can do too much at once. They're in a losing battle anyway. They're willing to do almost anything to weaken the dollar. I think at some point they may, since we're already on the MMT QE path, they may wipe all student loan debts if it means the dollar index is too strong. They may announce that they're just going to wipe away all the student loan debts. If things get bad enough, and you've talked about this, you've talked about the Plaza Accord, that's another rules change right there. So all of a sudden they have a meeting, right? And they just decide, like in 1985, to devalue the dollar 50%, because at that time, I think Japan and Germany had similar problems to what's happening now.
Correct.
So they had too much dollar denominated debt. The Fed wanted a weaker dollar because everyone is using Keynesian or neo-Keynesian economics and mercantilism. They want to export with a weaker currency. President Trump is tweeting about how the dollar, he tweets all the time about the dollar and how it's too strong. He's been doing this for over a year now. So you know, if he's saying this publicly, you know it's being discussed privately in meetings with the Treasury Secretary and also with the Federal Reserve Chairman. And
right.
the other major thing is I don't think that they will do this immediately. They will try everything else, maybe two or three times first, is if nothing else works, you go to what FDR did in 1934. And that's devaluing the dollar against gold. Now, The central bankers do not want to do this. This is the quote-unquote nuclear option. Jim Rickards has talked about this. This will be safe for last. They will try everything else. They will throw everything, including the kitchen sink, at it to try to prevent the dollar index from getting to those levels that Brent Johnson and Raoul Powell are talking about. Because in that scenario, you're going to have even more rapid defaults than you're having now.
Inside or outside the United States?
I think outside the United States, but then it would be like subprime affecting prime. So that would come here because you have so many multinational corporations that are dependent on doing business outside the United States, and also the global supply chain too. That would affect that as well.
Okay, so if they do a Plaza Accord 2.0, what would the transfer mechanism be, do you think, to get the dollars outside of the United States? So if you're Jerome Powell, not that I'd wish that upon you, Jason. But
no, thank you.
Get that out of your mind. I'm sorry I said that. But let's just say that we put you in charge of the Fed for a minute. I said, Jason, your only job is to devalue the dollar or to bring the DXY down to 70. How do you do that in the shortest amount of time?
You know, I think the Fed is really perplexed why the dollar index is so strong, because they've done so many, you've documented this better than anyone, George, so many different alphabet soup bailout programs. The bailout programs you're talking about, I speak with financial professionals and they don't even know some of them, like how the Fed circumvented the primary dealers to loan directly to some of these larger corporations. The stuff in there is enormous, and yet still the dollar index is strong. So this is the problem the Fed has. In my opinion, why this is happening is because the amount of dollar denominated debt and the dollar liabilities, these forward dollar swaps, are defaulting faster than the Fed can come up with new bailout programs. And until that changes, the Fed can't weaken the dollar.
Can't they just say, okay, we're going to create, call it $10 trillion, and go into the global FX market, and we're just going to buy $10 trillion worth of this currency, this currency, this currency, this currency, and bam. I mean, doesn't that drop the dollar, or is that not enough, or would that not work? What do you think about that?
In theory, it should, but I mean, Japan has been doing that too. So the problem is you have all these different countries trying to do it at the same time. That's the problem. They're all Japanified now, Japanification.
Think if the Fed tried to do it, then the other central banks, the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan, would see that and be like, okay, we've got you. If you do 10 trillion, we're doing 10 trillion to make sure that the dollar doesn't go down.
Yes, to make sure their currencies get weaker. The other major problem is what your Chris McIntosh, I listened to most of both of those interviews, I didn't finish the second one yet, is that a lot of flight capital has come in here to the US for the last couple of years into the asset markets because of the problems in the global economy that were already occurring, because people were seeing the problems with these emerging market countries that were having problems with the a commodities bear market and net capital outflows and exporting to China. So a lot of flight capital has already come into the US. And there's not a lot of places for all this flight capital from professional managed money for professional bond fund managers, global pension funds to put all this capital. So there's only so many places these trillions and trillions can go. And the US has benefited from this for the last couple years until lately. And that's why I think from a historical reference standpoint, what we had, including the stock market crash, was similar to 1927 to 1929. And now you have President Trump doing similar policy measurements to what Herbert Hoover and FDR are doing.
Well, that's not good if you know your history. Okay, so would you be on Brent's side as far as the stock market as well? I mean, everyone knows him from the dollar milkshake theory, but he also believes the stock market, the US stock market, will continue to go up, not necessarily because of fundamentals. In fact, he's very bearish on the fundamentals, but just because of all the capital coming in because other major markets are worse than the United States. Do you see that potentially taking the S&P up to where it was before, or do you think that there's just no way and all that capital is just going to stay in cash?
So I think it's really tough to say what the stock market will do. My educated guess is what happened after the 1929 crash and what happened in this 1970 stagflation. I think we'll get parts of both. Yeah, so I think that would be, we'll get that until the Fed figures out how to weaken the dollar and figures out how to juice things. The problem, though, is the real economy. And Brent has talked about money coming in. Well, flight capital has already been coming into the US for years now. There's been enormous amounts of capital from professional bond fund managers and pension funds and emerging market stock portfolio managers. So those guys have already left. I've covered this on my podcast and provided lots of articles and documented evidence that a lot of that capital over the last couple of years has already left those areas. China has enormous capital controls to prevent that. They're actually been trying a bunch of different schemes now for the last 6 to 8 months to try to trick foreign investors into investing more in China. They even had Ray Dalio do like a promotional video about the Chinese economy. And then Kyle Bass and Emma Molman have documented how the Chinese government is offering Wall Street high fees to funnel US investor pension fund money into China. So why would they need to block with capital controls and all this net capital outflows? So I think it's all, I think Brent was right that it would happen. I think it's just already happened. I'm not sure how much flight capital is left to come into the US because I think we already had our blow off stock market top in 2019. If you look at the charts of some of these stocks like Boeing and the general stock market indexes, I mean, there was no fundamental reasons whatsoever for Boeing to go up over 3x. In only a couple years. Its fundamentals had no justification whatsoever for it. Apple did, Apple's stock, if you look at the chart there from May 2019 up until before it crashed, I mean, that was a enormous parabolic move. So I think it's already happened.
Yeah, unlike Tesla, that's just purely driven on fundamentals, obviously.
well, there's Tesla has its loyal shareholders who will buy and hold or buy more or buy the dips. I think a lot of people now are turning bearish because they understand the earnings for these companies are going to be really, really bad. So yes, the Fed is trying to counteract with currency creation, more credit, bailout programs, all these different things that they're doing, all these rules changes and bailout programs, which is pretty much all that's left for now until the real economy is actually generating pre-global pandemic levels of cash flows or anywhere near those levels. And who knows how long it's going to be for that. There's a really good YouTube channel that your listeners, besides watching the documentary China Hustle, that's a must watch. But YouTube channel is China in Focus, and they're covering, they have unbelievable production value. I don't know which money is backing them, but they've been documenting what's going on in China, and it looks like there's a second wave with the global pandemic in China now outside of Wuhan. Yeah. So this thing could go on, George, longer. But with the bottom line here is when the global economy, the US economy are not generating cash flows, this means the Federal Reserve, there's not as much capital gains tax revenues and other tax revenues coming in to the federal government, state and local. And guess who has to fill the gap?
Yeah. So that takes me to my next question or topic of discussion here and kind of seeing or kind of asking you how you see this playing out over the next year or maybe 5 years. And to me, it just seems like if you understand that the Fed has to have asset prices stay inflated, they have to have debt continue to increase and they have to maintain confidence. That's what everything is built on. Then everything that they're doing totally makes sense. And I know that watching even Real Vision and Macro Voices, sometimes you hear these guys that are 10 times smarter than I am, but they'll say that, the Fed is doing this right now, and I don't think they'll go this far. Like, they won't go into the junk bond market. That's where they'll draw the line. Or they won't do this. But from my standpoint, just as the average Joe, I'm saying, well, they're going to do everything. Because there's nothing they won't do, because they're going to have to do that in order to continue to prop up those three things that I talked about earlier. So I don't see there being a limit to what they'll buy or what they'll backstop. And therefore, their balance sheet going to, I mean, who knows, $20-30 trillion. I see the deficit of the federal government. I mean, that's going to be at 20% of GDP if we're lucky. And then the Fed pegs the yield curve. So where does that take their balance sheet? And then, so my thought process, to take it a step further, is at what point does the Fed own a good portion of the equity and the debt for the entire S&P 500? And isn't that really taking us down the path of socialism? And then you watch my digital currency video, of course. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, central banks, by definition, are already socialism. They're anti-capitalism and anti-free market. So I would just talk about that. But prior to the global pandemic, George, I was in the stagflation tax and lie camp. So these governments, especially the U.S., thought that they could slowly manage a devaluation of the dollar against the other currencies. They could keep asset prices propped up, so at least the Fed wouldn't have to fund everything. So capital gains taxes for stocks, bonds, real estate would fund part of it. Normal taxes on business activity, inside the U.S. economy, and companies doing business outside that got taxed here in the U.S., that they could get tax revenues on that. The problem is that all that is offline. So that means I've seen projections that the Fed's going to be running that the U.S. government's going to be running a $5 trillion budget deficit for 2020. Jeez. And that's just on balance sheet. The off balance sheet stuff, we don't know the exact numbers. So the government, because they don't use generally accepted accounting principles, it's probably a lot more than that. So, but it's all these other governments are doing it too. So the currency markets are looking and seeing that all these governments are doing it. And that's why there's the confusion. And you have professional money managers that say, well, I'm retreating into treasuries. Well, for now, I'm retreating into dollars. I think personally, the Fed is watching the dollar index, watching the trade weighted dollar index, watching exchange rates, and they're seeing what they can get away with, you know, what asset purchases that they can do to try to weaken the dollar. And this is the game. It's going to be a cat and mouse game to try to prevent rules changes, bailouts, new asset purchase programs, maybe buying debt, creating currency units to wipe away things to try to prevent that dollar index rally from going to where Brent Johnson and Raoul Powell are saying. But yeah. the main problem, though, is the real economy. Because now the real economy is not providing all those tax revenues that all the state and local governments and the federal government were counting on.
Okay, so when we talk about what's preventing the Fed from doing X, Y, or Z, what is preventing them from just doing everything, from buying everything, from backstopping everything, from doing another 20 alphabet soup type of quote-unquote solutions? I mean, is inflation the only thing that's preventing them from doing that? And is that even preventing them from doing it?
Okay, so technically, I just interviewed Danielle DiMartino Booth on my channel. Not sure if you listened to that yet, but I asked her that point blank, and she said that the Federal Reserve Act only says that the Fed is legally allowed to buy U.S. Treasuries and also mortgage-backed securities. So everything else the Fed has done is illegal, it's a gray area, and it's a technicality that they haven't violated the law. What they did do, according to Jim Bianco, is they created, Danielle DiMartino Booth, in her own words, said it was Enron. They did off-balance sheet shenanigans, and they created dummy corporations, these special purpose vehicles. Yeah, and so the Fed is just financing these special purpose vehicles, and the U.S. Treasury owns the assets. So the Fed doesn't directly, it's wink, wink, nod, nod. It's ridiculous. So this is a way around the legality, because the Fed should have had to go to Congress, right, to get the rules changed. But that would have taken too long, and the asset prices would have fallen further, and there would have been a lot more defaults than we have now if the Fed had tried to do that, to go to Congress legally to get the rules changed.
Yeah, that's my point. They're just going to ignore whatever they need to ignore, or they're going to create some sort of makeshift temporary corporation or LLC or whatever they set up to do whatever they need to do to prop up asset bubbles and the confidence in the debt. It's just, I don't see there being any law or rule, Federal Reserve Act, the Constitution, whatever you want to talk about, that will prevent them from doing this, because at the end of the day, they'll just ignore it and do whatever they need to do. And who's going to, what's the downside? Like what authority is going to put the Fed in jail? You know what I'm saying? Who is in charge of the Fed? What if they do something wrong, even legally? Do we have a way to prosecute them? I mean, my guess would be absolutely not.
No, not at all. And in fact, the Republicans for the last couple of years were saying they wouldn't do MMT, but look what happened as soon as the asset prices fell, as soon as their stock, bond, and real estate portfolios, their own portfolios, the ones who didn't sit in those classified information meetings in Senate Intel hearings and House Intel hearings in late January, early February about the global pandemic, who didn't sell their stocks right away, you know, now their net worths are down too. So they're in favor of these to move up their asset prices back, so they look on paper as rich. I mean, here, let me just use a personal example. I love my parents, but my parents don't agree with anything I said. They didn't listen to my warnings about the oil market 2 months ago. They were relying on income from commercial real estate mortgages in New York City that were successful investments for years. So they were throwing off cash flow. But they didn't listen to anything I said. And a lot of baby boomers, George, not all baby boomers, because I've gotten emails from baby boomers who said they're against this, but a large amount of mainstream American baby boomers, Republican, Democrat, Independent, are in favor of higher asset prices. That will help their retirement. That will make them look on paper as higher net worth. So that's preventing harsh changes, I think. And then of course, unfortunately, George, capitalism gets blamed for all this. I think you and me both agree that central banking is not free market or capitalism.
Yeah, exactly. It's like Jim Grant talking about the Fed being the arson and the firefighter. It's just, it always goes back to that. So as far as the stock market, we understand the Fed is just going to do everything that they need to. They're going to print as much money as they need to. They're going to ignore any law, any Federal Reserve Act. They're going to ignore the Constitution. So long term, does that mean the release valve has to be the dollar? And if so, do asset prices just go up in nominal terms, but potentially go down in inflation-adjusted terms?
Yeah, the release valve, I think, is currencies. It's not just a dollar. It's all a currency. So there is no safe currency long term.
Right.
That's why I own gold and silver as insurance and wealth preservation and for savings. You can't save in these currencies.
Yeah.
Now, as far as asset prices go, it'll be we don't have enough data yet to see how the stock market is reacting to all these earnings. So it's still early in the earnings season. I think the first earnings announcement was only a week or two ago. We haven't had enough earnings announcements to see how each individual company in the S&P 500 or the Dow is reacting to all the earnings announcements, because the earnings announcements are going to be brutal.
Yeah.
If you want to see hockey sticks, take a look at the Fed's official balance sheet along with the jobless rates.
And have you seen M2?
Yeah. Yeah. Peter Schiff's son actually put that on his Twitter, Spencer Schiff.
Yeah. That M2 is just staggering. When you look at that, I mean, $1 trillion in the last 4 weeks, just unbelievable.
But look, here's the thing that most people are missing. Look what the Bank of Japan has just done in Japan. Look what the European Central Bank has done. Look what China's been doing for the last 12 months. And then also, as the global pandemic was getting worse, I think China was creating hundreds of billions of dollars worth of bailout relief in just like a month or two. So it's all these governments doing it, and this is distorting things enormously. So I think there's going to be a lot more volatility going forward. So there's going to be we're in a bear market rally now, but the major stock market indexes, and I predicted this for my Patreon account contributors behind the paywall a couple weeks ago, while everything was still crashing, I said the Fed there's really nothing to stop them, would do more and more intervention, and there would be some type of rally, and who knows how long it's going to last. But then the earnings are going to come out from these companies, and people are going to start to look at it, and the jobless claims are going to be brutal, and people are going to start wondering that it's only the Fed, what the Fed is doing. So the Fed's getting exposed. More people who didn't question the Fed in the past are starting to question the Fed now, which is good. Unfortunately, a lot of people who own assets are not asking the right questions yet. So they are questioning the Fed, but a lot of them still want the asset prices higher, and they would prefer the asset prices higher.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that a lot of the experts I've talked to always question the political willpower to have the Fed bail out whomever, whether it's foreign central banks, whether it's big corporations. But unfortunately, I just don't know that the average Joe really cares enough to come out on the street with the pitchfork. Do you disagree with that? Do you agree with that? And maybe in other words, the Fed comes out and they bail out Boeing, or they bail out all these corporations. They just don't let anyone fail. Meanwhile, people are stuck at home without a paycheck, having a hard time making ends meet, and they're saying, what the hell's going on? But I think if the Fed disguises all of these bailouts with these four-letter acronyms or abbreviations, then the average Joe isn't even going to know that the Fed's bailing out Wall Street or any of these other countries or central banks. What do you think about that?
Yeah, normally, unfortunately, a lot of the narrative in mainstream America still blame capitalism.
Yeah, right.
So the Fed gets away with it. Congress, both political parties, there's a $500 billion leveraged bailout slush fund for large corporations. They don't deserve this, to go and take advantage of small and medium-sized businesses that are temporarily distressed and buy those assets for pennies. It's absolutely horrible. There's no need for it whatsoever. And yet it was given because all these companies are lobbying Congress on both sides of the aisle. I really think that a lot of people don't understand. A lot of people don't even know what the Fed is. They can't name the Fed chairman, so they don't know. And that's part of the problem. So people just see, oh, the Fed controls interest rates. The Fed is very ambiguous, and that's what the Fed wants.
Yeah, I think that's why they name all these programs such crazy acronyms that no one's going to remember, or even, you know, the private dealer, what is it, the private dealer credit facility or funding facility. I mean, no one in the average Main Street is going to even care what that means or be able to connect those dots unless they're watching your videos or watching my videos. Well, all right. Well, I'm trying to think of a way to end this on a positive note, buddy.
I have a positive for you.
Okay, great. And then also I'd love, and I know my viewers will be just super pissed if I don't ask you about gold. And I mean, I know you really take a deep dive into not only gold and the oil markets and the producers. So I'd love to get your opinion on that quickly as well.
The major positive, in crisis, there is opportunity.
Yeah.
So people have a lot of free time. Some people may never have this much free time again. So there is a lot of opportunity now for someone to go and learn new skills, whether that's YouTube videos, podcasts like yours and mine, audiobooks, Skillshare masterclass, obviously not Paul Krugman's masterclass.
We live in strange times. How many times have you heard that lately?
That guy's like Jim Cramer. He's getting paid very high amounts of money to be a misinformation agent. Yeah. So there's the opportunity there. Instead of watching Netflix is fine once in a while, watching some TV, fine, maybe doing fun things on the computer. Playing video games or something with online is okay once in a while, but there is a ton of free time here to be an entrepreneur, to have a side hustle, to figure out with your friends and family new skills, new business opportunities. You have the internet still, and figure out how to make a little bit more money, build a side business now, maybe a little extra cash flow, and maybe in a year or two, when hopefully things are somewhat back to normal, you have the chance to have an extra $1,000 or $2,000 a month coming in, or you have the opportunity. You know, with me, my tiny little small online business, actually, it's never been better in the last five or
yeah,
6 months.
I was going to totally use you as an example with your Patreon and every your little side hustle. I mean, you're not a PhD economist. This is something you're self-taught, just like me. And bam, you've got the financial freedom to go out there and kind of take charge of your destiny and do what you want, which is really study macro. That's a great example.
Yes. And also look at the fundamentals of companies. And I worked, as you know, day jobs for investment analysts, and I was made fun of all the time for liking gold. So I was teased relentlessly for liking gold. And meanwhile, I think at the company I used to work at, my day job there, I recommended this was when I was, an investment analyst. So I was allowed to give recommendations, of just giving my opinion now. But yeah. I recommended Franco Nevada. This was 2013. It was like $40 a share. Now it's like $118 a share, and dividends have increased every year. I think that's the best stock pick, one of the best stock picks that company has ever had. And I think they took they deleted like all my articles from the website now.
All right. So let's step into that quickly, Jason. What do you think about gold? I know I just saw the CEO, I think, on Real Vision for Franco Nevada, if I'm not mistaken. And I know that's a company you really like and liked them for a long time. So where do you see gold going, and a time horizon, maybe short-term, long-term? And then what type of companies do you really like? The juniors, maybe some of the bigger players?
I avoid the juniors because a lot of the juniors right now, it's all about capital raising, and a lot of the juniors don't have a lot of cash on the balance sheet. When gold prices were higher before they crashed briefly, some of the juniors were able to raise a year or two worth of capital to do a drilling program. But there's really, and this is according to Nolan Watts at Sandstorm Gold, and he helps finance a lot of these companies. He does a royalty and streaming company. So Franco Nevada and Sandstorm Gold do not mine. They just, their business model, George, I know you're a real estate investor, is actually very similar to a rental property owner. So they just finance some of these either new gold mines that are about to be built or under construction, or they help repair the balance sheet of a producing miner for gold, silver, or copper. And then in exchange for that, they just get a new stream of cash flow. So they get a small amount of each company or mine's revenue. It's normally less than 8% of each mine. So some of these royalties are only like 1% or 2% of annual revenue. And these things add up. They allow for a lot more of a diversified, high margin cash flow business, because gold mining is so dangerous. Now, I think gold mining will be making good money once the miners are probably back online in 4 to 6 months. Four to six weeks. Why? You're going to have to edit that one out. Four to six weeks, I think more mines will be online. At least 30% of all the global gold mines and silver mines and copper mines are offline right now.
Right.
So with the global pandemic. So I think those will come back online. But with the low oil prices, which I was warning people about the oil market collapsing 2 months ago, and a lot of people didn't listen to me. With these low oil prices, the gold miners, unless there's problems at a specific mine, or the management teams are bad, or some of these governments maybe get greedy now with taxing some of the gold miners. But overall, industry-wide, overall, these gold miners, the margins should be potentially the best in history for the gold miners.
Because a lot of their costs are associated with energy.
Bingo. And also weaker currencies normally, and there's a lot of mines in emerging markets, the weaker currencies normally mean lower labor costs, basically, yes. Yes. Now though, that the miners are riskier because there's so many things that can go wrong at a mine. It's very capital intensive. There's not consistent free cash flow throughout all the cycle. So that's why the majority of my investment money is in royalty and streaming companies, because these companies already have diversified sources of cash flow from royalties and streams. So they're earning small amounts of cash flow from, in Franco Nevada's case, it's over 100 assets online generating cash flow. And Sandstorm Gold, it's over 20.
Wow. Okay, so when you're talking about the royalty streams, this might be a stupid question, but is that based on the net or the gross?
So they're getting NS. Okay, so for the royalties, they're NSR, net smelter royalties, but it's out of, so they're called NSRs, but it's, I think, out of gross revenues because the royalties are paid first.
So they're just, it's like a franchise fee where you own a McDonald's. If you're the franchisor and you're getting 10% of whatever their gross sales are.
They just collect checks. So, and then they reinvest it. So either with Franco-Nevada, they're paying more dividends or they're reinvesting into more growth. These are cash flow machines. Franco-Nevada is one of the only businesses listed on a publicly traded stock exchange. And people always complain about how Franco-Nevada is too expensive. The PE ratio is too high. I've been hearing this for years. I was hearing this when the stock was at $30 a share, $40 a share, $50 a share, $60 a share. Anyone who looks at the company sees that, looks at the PE price to earnings ratio, and it's very misleading because they're still growing. So they're taking those cash flows with high gross margins, and it's a fairly pure free cash flow business unless management over leverages the balance sheet or has some bad deals to write off, and they're reinvesting that into more growth. And then once those new cash flows come online, that means larger future dividends.
It would seem to me that this, just hearing you talk about this, as far as their business model, it's almost like they don't even have any admin costs. Like you could run that entire business with like 10 people, and then your whole cost is just the whatever you borrow, whatever leverage you use to give to these miners to basically buy that revenue stream in the future. And so you've got all this diversification. You've got, let's say, 100 deals out there. So even if 5 or 6 of those deals go bust, who cares? Because you're getting such a high percentage. And then your overhead is almost zero.
Exactly. Exactly. So you have Franco-Nevada, which has, I think, a little over 40 employees. And their revenue per employee is higher than, I think, is as high or higher than Goldman Sachs revenue per employee. I think and they have, I think they had, the last time I looked at the stock, I think it had a $16 billion market cap, give or take. So you have, they're making over $600 million per year in cash flow, mostly pure free cash flow. They've increased dividends, I think, every year since they re-IPO'd in 2007. So this is a very good business. It's almost never cheap, though. That's the thing. So right. It is still a growth business. They're not growing as quickly as they used to. But I think there's going to be a lot more opportunities after things restart because the copper miners are in serious, serious trouble. So once things restart, I think there's going to be a lot more deals for these firms, these larger precious metal royalty and streaming companies with the copper miners who are going to need capital infusions that is not available in the equity markets. They're going to need to do streaming deals on gold or silver streams.
Got it. So Franco-Nevada is not just gold. It's just they go into copper as well and silver, I assume.
Okay, so Franco-Nevada, they do deals with copper miners, but they're for gold streams or silver streams. So streams are a little bit different than royalties. I don't want to go into all the details. I save that for patrons. Also, available. Yeah, also it's available on the Franco-Nevada website. They have all the terms that explain the contracts differently. But okay. Franco-Nevada, the majority of the revenues are related to gold and silver. So streams or royalties in those. So 80% of their annual revenues are from gold and silver. And then they have a 20% oil and gas royalty portfolio. They were actually minting currency off of the shale oil bubble. So they had all these royalties that were paying out enormous gains for years off their oil and gas royalties, because the more these shale companies drilled, the more they made. Now, that they may take a hit on that in the short term, but I suspect that they will probably do some more deals for growth on the gold and silver side. So I don't think the company's in any jeopardy of going bankrupt. They don't leverage their balance sheet with debt, but their oil and gas royalty revenues could cause a little short-term headwinds. The stock did crash, I think, from like $115 a share down to like $85, but I think that was a buying opportunity at $85 a couple weeks ago. And now it's back up. I think it's 120. It might be around 120 in the last couple of days.
All right, buddy. Well, I want to be cognizant of your time. That was just a fantastic conversation. Really, really opened up my mind. So for my viewers who want to find out more about what you do or go to your Patreon or your YouTube, or I know you're super active on Twitter, how can they find out more information about what you do?
Okay, so YouTube channel, Wall Street for Main Street, WALLSTFORMAINST. I don't have anything on my website right now. I need to do some more work on that. I'm only charging $5 a month for the content behind the paywall. A lot of people, in their own words, not mine, have said it's one of the best values out there. There are paid newsletters that charge like $80 a month or more that have less good research work and content and analysis. There's audio podcasts. For example, I did an audio podcast, I think it was either the end of January or the first week of February, and it was an oil market podcast for patrons behind the paywall there, going through in detail problems with the oil market and many different companies, including how the highest cost, most indebted shale oil producers in the Bakken, if the oil price went lower, they would go bankrupt. And so it wasn't rocket science. It was just good, hard work, research, analysis, predicting that if the oil price continued to go lower, the higher cost, most indebted oil companies would go bankrupt first. And that's what happened in the last 10 days with Whiting Petroleum. So that company was predicted to go bankruptcy over 2 months ago. And there's a lot of other articles there about gold mining stocks, silver mining stocks, royalty and streaming companies, trading volatility, technical analysis, and fundamental problems with some of these consumer staple stocks.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Okay. And what's your Patreon page, Jason? Is it just your name?
Patreon.com/Wall Street, WALLSTFORMAINST. I think that's all it is.
Yeah, guys, if you enjoy my channel or what I do, my content, you're going to absolutely love what Jason does. So check out his YouTube channel for sure. Check him out on Twitter. And then if you're interested, definitely go to his Patreon page and consider subscribing there, because he really gets into the nitty gritty on all of these things that we're not only concerned with, but the opportunities that may present themselves with what's happening here in the, we'll call it the Cerveza sickness pandemic. So Jason, thanks buddy for your time. I cannot wait to do it again.
I really enjoyed this, George. You're doing an amazing job. Your channel is, I think, the fastest growing in our space. Congratulations.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.